the Buddha, Sri Dharma, Sri Sangha. I didn't get a chance last time. I want to talk a little bit about this part in plates 37 and plate 37 called the Lord's Will, where a master says the following. She says, she sees Shakyamuni Buddha rise up from where he is standing and become absorbed into the great golden cosmic Buddha that I now see in the sky. He is taken into the cosmic Buddha and yet is separate from him. He is not the cosmic Buddha, but there is nothing in him that is not of the cosmic Buddha. The two are inseparable, they are one, and they are different. You know, you can't see the eternal, and yet everywhere you look, there is the eternal. So here the eternal, the cosmic Buddha, has to be represented by a Buddha in the sky. And Shakyamuni Buddha, who always represents the highest human realization of enlightenment and human oneness with the eternal. Shakyamuni Buddha is shown as at one and the same time, one with and separate from the eternal. And here's just another place in which Reverend Master, who had long known at this point, long known the teaching of the all is one and the all is different, she's being shown through the vehicle of the senses, she's being shown this oneness and difference. In the world of our ordinary daily life, especially in the world that we were educated to see and to react to, you can't have two things being the same and yet different. The logic doesn't allow for that. Unless you have a different kind of logic that does allow for it. But in mysticism has always had its own logic, you might say. And in mysticism, this simultaneity of oneness and difference does exist. And there are very, very practical implications of training in the understanding of the all is one and the all is different. We think what it means when we say that any human being has the Buddha nature. Think what we mean. Or any being has the Buddha nature. It has, you know, direct implications for our own training. How can I set myself in my own head above a being who has the Buddha nature? Any being. So right there you see one of the precepts. Do not be proud of yourself and devalue others. What gives me the right to be angry at someone if they have the Buddha nature? There you have another precept. How could I willfully deceive someone if they have the Buddha nature? You see, all the precepts come into play here. The precepts are the practical implications of a genuine spiritual understanding. And also, the precepts, training in the precepts, help us develop a genuine spiritual understanding. Similarly, you know, look at the all is different. A person has the Buddha nature, and a person can do very unwise things. So if someone in whom I recognize the Buddha nature is doing something unwise, then it is wise for me not to join that person in the doing of it, and not to encourage them in the doing of it. Kazan said, or Dogen said, I guess he's the one that's the commentary and the precepts is attributed to, you know, do not allow anyone to speak of another's fault. Do not allow anyone to make a mistake in Buddhism. If we join someone in making a mistake in Buddhism, we also make a mistake in Buddhism. So there's a practical implication that all is different. Yes, all beings possess the Buddha nature, and not all beings are expressing their Buddha nature 100%. Not all beings are in harmony with that which they possess. If you get stuck in the all is one, you end up in what's called love and light delusion. Ramesh used to say that's the most dangerous of all delusions because it's the one that looks most like truth. I've talked about the fact that all truths are not equal in the spiritual life. And the belief that all truths are basically equal, that every position is equally valid with every other, or every truth is equally valid with every other, is one of the aspects of love and light delusion. And a lot of what passes for spirituality is actually just very low-grade spirituality where people got stuck in love and light. Compassion is a wonderful thing. Love is a wonderful thing. And if we would know what love truly is, we have to not be swollen-headed and set up our own standards. One can willfully insist on the oneness of everything. And that leads to terrible suffering, actually. What can be wrong with this? This is Buddha too. You see? Where are the precepts? Wait a minute. Why not join in with that? Those people have the Buddha nature. You see? You need the all is different as well. The capacity to wisely discriminate between what is beneficial spiritually and what is not. What is wise and what is not. What is genuinely compassionate and what appears as compassion but is actually selfishness. For a monk, you could say that their teacher, their master, stands in the position relative to them of Shakyamuni Buddha to his disciples. And that's quite a responsibility for a master. It's also a responsibility for the disciple, and neither one of them can get out of their essential responsibility. Shakyamuni Buddha was a human being, and Shakyamuni Buddha made mistakes. Rinpoche Master Jiyu is a human being, and Rinpoche Master Jiyu made mistakes. I'm a human being, I make mistakes. How does a disciple deal with that? Well, you have to learn to make use of the all is one and the all is different, and put them into practice. The All is One. My Master is the Buddha for me. The All is Different. My Master is human like me and can make mistakes. It's not my job as a disciple to follow the mistakes of my Master, nor to judge my Master for his or her humanity. Back to the All is One there. It's a real razor's edge. And genuine discipleship is a difficult haul for anyone. If one wishes, one can kind of sugarcoat in one's mind the old days and think that it was easier. You only have to read the stories of the old days to see that it was no easier. It was never easy. There was never a master born who lived up to expectations of a foolish disciple. Nor is it any master's job to do so. It's a master's job simply to do his or her own training to the best of his or her ability and trust the disciples to do the same and keep pointing towards the eternal, to point the way. All is one and all is different. In this vision, River Master saw a being in white that she recognized as Shakyamuni Buddha. That could just as well have been Koh Zenji or Dogen or Keizan. Some of us, since River Master died, have had visions in which we saw Riven Master. That could just as well have been Koh Zenji or Dogen or Keizan or the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. It's going to be that which represents the eternal for us. And the Master is often used by the eternal in that way to help the disciple. Do not become lost in the All is One by attempting to cling to the All is One. Do not become lost in the All is Different by ignoring the All is One. As I said before, it's really important to realize that there are perceptual implications of all of these experiences that Rim Master is having here. They may be blissful experiences, and that's wonderful. And that's Rim Master reaping the merit of her training there. But don't think that the whole point is the bliss. The Eternal is very practical minded. And there's teaching. There's teaching in each of these visions. There's teaching that has perceptual implications. The next chapter here is called Do Not Stay in Heaven. Remember that much earlier on, early in her retreat, Rim Master hit a place that she named Heaven is the Most Dangerous of All Places. And you can see you're going round and around here, hitting the same thing in different, at a deeper place now. But if you remember, when she first spoke of heaven, she spoke of it as a reward for the cleansing, karmic cleansing that she'd done at that point. and she could have taken the reward and died at that point. But she chose to keep going and undertake the deeper cleansing and conversion of karma. Here again, she's hit heaven, and she's hit heaven in a much more complete form, displayed much more fully. And now she's in a very different place. She's not in that desperate place she was earlier on. But once again, she's entitling this a chapter that has to do with heaven with a caution in it. First it was, heaven is the most dangerous of all places. Now it's, do not stay in heaven. And some people in religion believe that heaven is the goal of the religious life, to go to heaven. It may be that some Buddhists believe that, but I'm not one of them. My goal is, in training, is not to go to heaven. My goal in training, as Rim Master's goal, is to follow the Eternal wherever the Eternal leads. And that's a very different matter. She says, it is the same evening, and we are celebrating the closing ceremony, Nenju, after which the monks rest. As each of the names of the 10 Buddhas is recited, they appear before me. Now I know why the Holy Lotus Scripture is included as one of the 10 Buddhas. It refers to the waveless sea that is filled with all beings on their lotus thrones. When I first started experiencing these things a little while ago, I became frightened lest I be caught up in the experience. But the warning against seeing Buddhas or demons is very specific. It is only dangerous to see them when you feel elation or fear or cling to them. If I remain unattached to these experiences, all will be well. I'd like to point out, and I'm sure Rim Master would point out, that to feel elation or fear is not the same as to be attached. In the sense that she's speaking of it here. Attaching, as used here, means to seize onto something with your will. To try to push something away in the case of fear, or to try to hold on to something in the case of elation. To push away that which is painful, to try to hold on to that which is blissful. And she's saying, the danger lies in doing that. What one feels at a particular time, one can't very well help. There's times when we feel fear and we can't help it. There's times when we feel elation and we can't help it. What we do, we can help. You see. In other words, you know, she's saying, if I really meditate, then I'm okay here. And that's true. What is it to not grab after and to not push away? In the true and deepest sense, it's to meditate. Clinging, what we call clinging, is very strong and very willful attaching. Glomming on very willfully. And that is very, very dangerous. It says, because I almost made this mistake of attaching, the sea and the lotuses were less vivid towards the end of today, and this worried me. When one of the monks asked the Lord the reason, he was told that to see them vividly all the time did not make for strong stems on the lotus blossoms. I understand the Lord's words and am grateful for this teaching. Look. All the monks there are her disciples, by the way. So note the humility. She's actually listening to teaching that's coming through one of her disciples and bowing to it. No pride here. Of course, the stem of the lotus represents training. So the teaching that's being given here through one of her disciples, it's a very good teaching, is that if you're always kind of enjoying heaven, you tend to neglect your training. And, or you can do so. And I have to say that in all my years of training, I have again and again proved this true, that it's I make my biggest progress when I'm most conscious of my suffering, not when I'm least conscious of it. I amaze myself through the years at my capacity to simply forget how serious a matter it is what we're doing when the pressure is off. And then to rediscover it when the pressure was back on. I don't think I'm unusual in this. I think that's how we all tend to act. And that's why we all kind of need to have our suffering keep coming up and reminding us of what the real point is. She says, the root of the lotus is in the world as we know it. The root of the lotus is right there in the mud of worldliness. Good old greed, hate, and delusion. It's right there in the mud. She says, accordingly as we train ourselves, so the stem of the lotus pushes upward towards the surface of the sea. If the stem is weak or becomes broken, the blossom will die. What a precious teaching this is. You see here this, her mind and heart are completely open to the teaching. And therefore she's really absorbing it. At a time like this, a person, it seems like you're just absorbing the Dharma, not just with your mind, but through your whole being, through your body. It's an indescribable. One just has to experience it. One is aware that one is absorbing the teaching through one's whole being, not just through the intellect, and that the teaching is being given directly and immediately to one's whole being, not just to the intellect. The intellect's like the last thing that gets it. Reharmonization is not just getting wiser intellectually or the brain kind of cottoning on. It's whole being reorientation due to a whole being cleansing and conversion of the karma, the karmic jangles. She goes on to say, it is the morning of the 4th of November and everything is very clear and bright again. Not quite as clear as on that first day, but the colors are still very vivid. The beings are strolling about in highly colored clothing. I climb to the top of a very beautiful grassy hill behind the main temple and just sit there enjoying myself. I have to say here, the pictures in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom in this book are not colored. But River Master had a scroll made that has all of these visions, or most of them, in it. And River Master had some of the really good artists draw the pictures, and River Master, over a considerable period of time, very carefully, with a set of watercolors and really nice brushes, she painted the colors as she remembered them. And they have this at the Abbey. This, a real treasure, this scroll. And And those paintings, remember the paintings that used to be in the windows of the ceremony hall of the abbeys? Those were some of the visions in there. And they were painted in the colors as she remembered them. The Rim Master had a wonderful memory, and she remembered incredible detail in these visions. The only way I can explain this, and I've said many times in these series of talks, I don't understand this, and I'm not trying to. I just think the Eternal just takes over our senses in a way to give us such experiences. And just floods into our senses the complete, you know, experience, complete in spiritually and complete in the terms of the senses, each of the senses. What is happening? This is just exactly, by the way, what happens after one dies. And at one of the later talks, I'll talk about that. I'll just actually take some time, probably do more than one talk on that, and just draw a comparison with what is happening here. As I've said so many times, don't think this is just like symbolic and just imagination. It's not just anything. She says, there is a spring caught as a fountain on top of the hill under a pavilion. I believe this is the first time she mentions the fountain. The fountain is a very, very important metaphor in this teaching, as we'll see again and again. She says, sometimes the water in the fountain flows down the hill in streams across the green grass of the sea. And then the streams dry up and steam gently in the sun, leaving the grass brighter. She's not speculating about what it means here, but there's meaning here. Say, and there is meaning here. The water in the fountain, again, is the water of the Spirit, the flowing love of the Eternal. The fountain is this welling up of this love and gratitude, the welling up of the water of the Spirit in our being in the universe. And as it, in this welling up, spiritual transformation and conversion happen. When there is an abundance of the water, it flows abundantly. And when it draws back again, or when that flow for any reason dissipates, then that which has been touched by that flow is enlivened, as this grass is shown being brighter. A wonderful description of the flow and ebb of the flow and ebb that we experience, our experience of the flow and ebb of the love of the Eternal and of our love for the Eternal. It's just two aspects of one circulation of love. And every time that happens, we are spiritually enlivened and deepened by it. She says, goes on to say, just sitting here, I say to myself, what shall I do today? Nobody seems to be going to the temple at all. That's the temple on the hill in her vision. There is a ceremony here in Shasta. Maybe there should not be one. I will go to the temple anyway. I go into the temple and there is a huge statue of what I have seen in the sky, the cosmic Buddha with Shakyamuni Buddha, a very great sitting Buddha, and the Shakyamuni Buddha standing on the Buddha's hand, resting in the lap. says, I just sit down on the floor. No one else seems to be here, but this does not matter. My eyes insist on closing. I do not dare to look. Something comes and holds me and then passes on. When I can open my eyes again, I see that Shakyamuni Buddha is embracing a shadowy figure further on. There are other shadowy figures in the hall. I go outside the temple and sit by the sea, putting my toes in it. There are times when we know ourselves to be embraced by the love of the eternal. It may not be a physical embrace in the sense in which the embrace of another human being is a physical embrace. And there are times when we know that the love of the eternal embraces us and is meant for us as human individuals, as it is meant for all beings. And it is never just meant for us. There's no one uniquely embraced by the love of the eternal. Look what is happening here in this temple. First, our master experiences herself as being embraced. And then immediately thereafter, she recognizes that others are also being embraced. The Eternal is very careful to give you every opportunity not to become swollen-headed. It's amazing how often we don't take every opportunity and go ahead and become swollen-headed anyway. But that's not because the Eternal wasn't in there trying. She says, there are a lot of buds coming up in the sea, and one of them I know is one of the monks here. I am told which one, but I may not tell him. It is a green bud. I think for a moment Mara has ensnared me, for I have never before seen a boat on the waveless sea. But it is Shakyamuni and some of the beings inspecting the new buds. Ramesh used to say, the Eternal has a sense of humor. I really like this part where Shakyamuni Buddha is out in a boat and they're looking at the lotus buds, checking them out. Oh, this one needs a little care here. This one needs a little here. Let this one alone. He'll be all right. You know, you can just kind of visualize it. You know, the garden of the we're all buds in the garden of the eternal, being looked after by the eternal. Shakyamuni Buddha is here representing the attentiveness, the care of the eternal. She says, the bud belonging to the monk here is about 4 inches below the water. It is very green. Shakyamuni Buddha looks down saying, ah, he is very interested in his buds. He returned to the shore in his boat. I love it. You know, there are many ways. This is just one of the ways in which one can experience this incredible sense, this vivid, again, kind of total body and mind sense of the amazing care with which the Eternal is looking after us. And the only thing that rivals the amazingness of this care with which the Eternal is looking after us is our own capacity to not get it and not see that. And to think that we're each of us kind of out there in the universe on our own, not being looked after. This, of course, is in many respects the plight of many modern people, believing themselves to be existentially alone without a God. And, you know, this is not true. But it comes from looking for God in the wrong place, looking for God in externals, not looking for God within one's own heart, which is the only place you're really going to find it. You know, the contemplative path is a path of looking within one's own heart, looking within oneself for that which is true for oneself. And the person who truly does this, does it sincerely, will not be disappointed. You will find that which you seek.